Hey everyone, thanks for joining. Today I am speaking with Bruce Pardee. Bruce is the executive director of Rights Probe, a think tank about civil rights, and he's also a law professor at Queen's. I was hoping to have him on today to speak a bit about government overreach, and we'll just see where the conversation goes from there. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for coming on.
Wait, thanks very much for having me.
So I met up with you last July, I believe it was a Lighthouse event in Toronto. And then, it's all about parents and pushing back on some of the stuff in schools. Like I said, wanted to talk about government overreach, but this is one of the things where I think government is overreaching in certain ways. And we don't really have to discuss this, but like, this is where what they did during COVID, all the stuff about the WHO, like I don't know enough about it. So, I try to avoid that conversation. If you know more about it, we can discuss it. But it was the overreach coming from the government on aspects of our lives. Like one example for me was Trudeau forcing all the universities to have diverse chairs. That affects how academia is run, that affects how academia is, functions. And then that has a trickle down effect of what's going on in, society as a whole, because, they always say, oh, the leaders of the future, right, are coming out of universities. Well, if they're all thinking in one direction, it has that. So I don't know where you, like what you're focusing on and, where you want to take that.
Right. Okay. Well, I want to agree with you that the government is overreaching everywhere. It's in so many areas of society. But my perspective on this is that people are objecting to government overreach without recognizing the real problem. And that is that government has been given the mandate to supervise us. And then when they do it in a way that some people don't like, the government is accused of overreach. Now, I don't disagree with them. It is overreach. But you have to go back to that mandate. So let me tell you a politically incorrect story. A
Go
number of
ahead.
years ago, I've told the story a number of times, just to make a point. So a number of years ago, I caught up with an old friend. I hadn't seen her for quite a while. And she was in the early stages of this, well, romantic relationship. And we sat down for a cup of coffee, and she was complaining about this man in her life. And this is a direct quote. She said, "He won't take charge in the relationship. And when he does," she said, "he does it wrong." Now, people laugh at that, and they should. And the joke is, you can't expect someone to take charge of something and then supervise how they do it. And the point is, that's what we've done with government. We have given government the mandate to manage society. And then when they do it in a way that we don't like, we accuse them of overreach. Now, I agree that they're overreaching, but the real problem is the mandate. I would like to suggest that the necessary way out of all of this overreach, whether it's in the schools, whether it's COVID, whether it's universities, whether it's speech, whether it's any of a whole host of things, I mean, the list is a mile long, is to back up and say, you know what? This is not the kind of role governments should have in society. In fact, let's re-examine what government is for. People widely think the governments exist for the purpose of solving social problems. And my argument would be that as long as you give them that job, as long as you think that's legitimate, then they are going to overreach. By definition, it's a structural thing. You have to attack the premise. And we're not doing that.
Okay, I agree with you there that we've given up control of our own lives, hoping that the government is going to look after us.
Yes.
I think part of the problem, though, is I'm assuming we're roughly the same age as our generation, like Gen X. I joked around that Gen X would be famous for our apathy if we did, if we'd cared enough.
Right.
You know, and like I think we grew up in a time where you could trust institutions. You know, if it comes out of Harvard Medical School, or here in Canada, if it comes out of McGill Medical School, or or someplace like that, oh well, we can trust that because the institutions, are
Exactly.
working on our behalf.
Exactly so.
And I don't think people realized the turn the institutions were taking. And so Gen X being Gen X, we were a very apathetic generation. And we're kind of like, oh well, it's working. Let's not rock the boat. And we became accustomed to these institutions, and some of them are governmental, and they were the ones looking after us, and we became accustomed to that. I think people just like I think apathy was a big part of it. We didn't look into it enough. We didn't care about what was being done or said. I mean, in my own case, I wasn't anyone famous. I wasn't a pundit. I didn't, speak out about stuff. I only started speaking out about anything a little after 9/11. I was speaking with friends and stuff. They'd tell me about, they knew I come from a Muslim background. They tell me about Islam. I'm like, whatever you're hearing is wrong. Like, that's not correct. And I would try to, clear it up for them. And then I went overseas, and it was only after I got back that I just realized like how messed up things were. Like, I use the analogy of the frog and the, boiling water. Like, I was a frog that was just thrown in, and everyone had just been kind of like, enjoying the hot bath.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's, I think it's that. I think people just got used to it, and we didn't notice how bad the institutions were got. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree, but I think it might be even more fundamental than that, in the sense that most people who are alive today don't have anything else to compare it to. So most people alive today have been born into a society that is managed by an administrative state, a managerial state. And that's what they think the role is. And it wouldn't occur to most of them to wonder whether or not that's correct because they haven't lived in anything else. So if you ask somebody on the street, should the experts and bureaucrats and technocrats in the state be managing society? The response might be, well, what else is government for? But to solve our social problems and to keep us safe. So yeah, apathy, sure. But even more fundamentally, it's the idea which has existed, by the way, in society for a long time. This is not just a COVID thing. It's not just this decade. This has been evolving in Western society for a long, long time. I mean, decades, decades, century. So that you arrive here today and we think, government's now overreaching. Well, why are they overreaching? Well, because that's the way it's set up now. And if in order to really reverse that, you have to re-examine the role of government and the premises upon which we are governed. And we're as I alluded to earlier, that we're a long way from having that kind of conversation most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, something like what you're saying there brings to mind something that I'd heard Douglas Murray say a long time ago, and that was freedom's never really been a popular idea.
Exactly,
You
right.
know, people want to go on with their lives, they want to look after, pay their bills, go to work, look after their families. But the concept of freedom, I think we just took for granted. I mean, I took free speech for granted. And it was only when I got back from overseas and I saw how screwed up things were
Yeah.
that I was like, wait a minute, we're losing our speech.
Yes, right.
And, so I think, I mean, when you say it's been going on for 100 years, I mean, I haven't done a study of it, so I'm
Well,
gonna.
I don't mean to overstate it. It's not like we've been in this situation for 100 years. What I mean is that the origins and there, this historical dispute about this when, the administrative state began its life. Some people in the U.S. suggest that it happened in a big way with the New Deal following the Great Depression. In the UK, people make the case that it sort of really got its legs after World War II. In Canada, in Canada, we've always sort of had a differential society, partial to authority. So who knows exactly when, but my point is that the systems we have now in place have been developing in this way for a long time. And so it is not possible to suddenly look around now and say, oh, look, something suddenly has changed, because that's not so. In a sense, where we've arrived at today, I might say, is maybe not an inevitable result, but a not surprising result of the governing premise that we have both in our structures and in our heads. We believe, most people believe, that expertise and administration is necessary today. Government, that is, government bureaucracy, government expertise is necessary for us all to make our way through our lives. I'm questioning the very existence of regulation. And even those people who are hot under the collar about all the bad things coming down the pike right now, the restrictions on speech, the overreach on COVID, the abuse in the schools, all of these things, even they, not to a person, of course, but I think a lot of those people would still have a bit of difficulty coming to the conclusion that, you know what? Governments shouldn't be in this business. We shouldn't have public schools. We shouldn't have public health care. We shouldn't have all these things, because if we do have them, they're going to go wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you there. It's, I think, one of the worst phrases that, I remember even growing up, and hearing it now, it just makes me cringe, is, oh, there ought to be a law.
Yes,
It's
right.
like, n no, there shouldn't. Okay, I mean, okay, I agree with you there. Like, my dad, if he'd still be alive today, I think you'd classify him as a libertarian. He was, said the only purpose for government is to defend its citizens. Like, you need a military, you need a police force, you need things like that. But he's like, get out of everything else. We don't need government in everything else. And I tend to agree with that. Maybe I'm, looking through rose-colored glasses here, but I do think we do need some social nets. And I mean, I think that's where we get into the problem, because as soon as you start talking about social nets, you need a bureaucracy, then you need an administration to run it, and then these people are going to want to perpetuate their jobs.
Yes.
And as soon as you put in a bureaucracy, it's going to evolve, and it's going to, you're going to have to fill out all your forms in triplicate and all the BS that goes along with it. So.
It's almost an ironclad rule that whenever you create an institution, especially a government institution, then that government institution's first priority is its own preservation and expansion. And there doesn't seem to be any way to establish them without having that go along with it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, we mentioned COVID a couple of times. I think Quebec was one of the most restrictive provinces. And the rules made absolutely no sense. At one point, we had a curfew from 10 p.m. to 8 a.m., and I think that went on for
Yes.
like almost a year.
Right.
It was ridiculous. Like, it made no sense. How is that curfew stopping COVID?
Right. 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 But so and of course, Quebec had a lot of competition, but you might be right. But there were rules that didn't make sense everywhere. So a lot of people who oppose those rules make this case that these rules were not based upon, solid scientific information. And fair enough. I tend to agree with that myself, but I would go further though and say, look, the problem is that once you give governments the mandate to do these kinds of things, and this is something that people don't realize about the law, often government officials have a mandate to make decisions, and they don't have to show that their decisions are based upon science. It's just that's not one of the conditions of exercising authority. Our legal system is based upon authority, not upon information. And people who are screaming about the fact that the information was wrong and the results were bad, I mean, I agree with them. But that is not a legal argument. That is not, you're not making the case that they weren't allowed to do what they did, because they're not obliged to show their work. They have the authority. The authority is contained in the statute. The statute is valid because a government got elected. And that's the end of the story a lot of the time. And people don't understand that the people who are acting on behalf of the government don't have to justify themselves, because they are who they are. And that's why I think we need a different system of government, a different set of premises, I suppose I would put it, for the way that we are governed.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, look, I think there's too much bureaucracy. I think the government's involved in a lot, and I'd love to see a lot of these agencies just get cut down. But if you want a new system of government, I mean, that's like, I would like to, like, I'm not going to push back against that, but I would like to see what's being proposed, you know, instead of just jumping in, you know, feet first and not looking.
Well, it's a conundrum, right? Because, and I'm not speaking concretely here, because the prospect of getting a different form of government in place is non-existent right now. So I'm not suggesting anything like, you know, trying to open up the Constitution or anything substantial like that, because that's just not practical. But given that it's not practical, we have a real problem, because a lot of the other stuff that we're arguing about is fiddling in the margins and is not actually attacking the what I believe is the source of all the difficulty. And so the question is, well, you know, where do we go from here? So, you know, within the so-called freedom movement, for example, I think a lot of the activity and discussion may be missing the plot. A lot of the attention now is on all the evil people, you know, all the corrupt people, all the people who planned to do bad, all the people who lied, all the people who, you know, made bad policies, and the problem is being portrayed as a whole lot of bad people. And well, there are a lot of bad people, to be sure. But for me, the question is, well, what is it about our governance system that allowed these bad people and their bad ideas to take center stage? That means that our system is broken. Not that there's a lot of bad people, because there are always bad people. There are always bad people around. And in fact, you know, if you listen to people like Hannah Arendt, who made the point that you know, evil is banal. Evil exists in the hearts of everyone. And if you have a system of government that lets that evil be unleashed, well, then you're in real trouble. And the whole idea was to create a system of governance for ourselves that would avoid the worst of human nature. And right now, it's not delivering.
You know, speak from my experience here. So I was away from 2002 to about, I got back to Canada in early 2014. So I missed pretty much all the Harper years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I came back, he was in power for a little over a year, and then Trudeau came in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd had the, whatever, I don't know, you want to call it good fortune or misfortune or whatever, I'd met Trudeau. He was in school with my sister at university. She was in classes with his younger brother at Brebeuf, which is a CJEP in Quebec, private CJEP. And so I'd met him, and I'm like, okay, my first opinion of him when I met him, and like, he was in university, I was finishing up, and was, you know, he was like, that's a frat boy that's going to commit date rape. That was my first opinion of Trudeau. And then, you know, I'd met him a couple of times when he got into politics, because a friend of mine was doing work for the Liberal Party, and I went to a couple of events and I met him a couple of times, and my opinion didn't really change much. The guy was, I thought he was an idiot when he was, you know, in university. I thought he was an idiot when he was in politics. I couldn't vote for him, and I couldn't vote for the liberals. I mean, I think that's one of the things that it's gone wrong in our politics is people are voting for the leader of the party. They're not voting for the MP in their riding that will best serve them. I think that's, we became too Americanized in that way. Like we're voting for a prime minister, we're not voting for the our representative. So I think that's kind of caused some of this. But then I saw Trudeau come in. So like I didn't see much of the Harper stuff. I saw some of the things that he was doing. I wasn't too fussed about his niqab thing. I actually agreed with him about that. It was more things like, they were going to control what information got out of government agencies. And then, Trudeau came in and just doubled down on that, things like that. Like that's what I didn't like about Harper. But I couldn't, like, I wasn't going to vote NDP, and I couldn't make myself vote a party that had Trudeau in power. So I spoiled my ballot in 2015. I spoiled it in 2019. In 2021, I voted conservative just because I wanted, I was like, I didn't want Trudeau, I didn't want the liberals, and I didn't want the NDP. And I thought, okay, maybe the conservatives would come in. But like I agree with you that, I think I mentioned this that night in July, like last July when we were at the Lighthouse event, that don't look for anyone to come save you. Like I don't think, like all these people saying, oh, Poilievre's going to come in and he's going to fix all this. It's like, no, he's not. No one is. And I think we've become too accustomed to, oh, someone's going to do that for us. Someone's going to do that for us. Someone's going to do that for us. I think we've lost self-resilience. I think we've lost the ability to concern ourselves looking after us, like to take care of ourselves. Like I would love if a new government came in and did what can't remember his name. I could never pronounce it correctly. Miel or whatever his name is. And
Oh, in Argentina. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. We need a lot more of him around.
And but even that, like, I don't think people should be, no one is coming to save us. No one is coming to, fix
Well,
all this.
those people who might be coming to save us, like the Argentinian president, and I greatly admire what he's been able to do in a short period of time. He balanced the budget already. In a country which was nowhere near that, it was catastrophically the other way. So I don't want to eliminate the possibility that we would, have good leaders in our midst who are willing to do important and necessary things. But I agree with you that in order for them to be able to do that, they need something else has to happen first, at least. And that thing is that the people have to change their minds about what they really want. And I don't see that happening in Canada anytime soon. Yeah, people are down on Trudeau, and I totally agree with him. He and his government have done an awful lot of damage to this country. And I don't know if it's able to be reversed or not. But let's assume that it is. It's important to point out, I think, that an awful lot of the bad things that have come down the pike in the past little while are matters that are under provincial jurisdiction. I mean, the feds can't touch them. I mean, yeah, the feds have done all kinds of bad things, but the provinces have too, and the federal Liberal government doesn't control those people. They've made their own decisions, and some of those decisions were made by provincial conservative governments. So there's a lot of blame to go around. And I hope Trudeau loses next time around, but that's not, as you say, that's not going to fix the problem.
I harp on a lot on the woke stuff. I mean, I could talk about overreach, the right wing as well. I mean, there's more so of that in the US than there is here, but my thing is we've got a generational fight on our hands. Like, okay, you need someone to come in and say, okay, we're going to cut federal funding for universities that push DEI. Let's just say as an example. Okay, great. I'm all on board for that. But it's got to be done properly so that, I respect academic freedom. I respect the right, I want people to be able to expose to a lot of different things. But at the same point, I want the, academia has failed. Like they've broken trust with the populace. And so That, I mean, if it wasn't for universities, I'm not saying it's the sole cause, but I mean, that's where this stuff came from, and that's how it got out into the population. That's, people trained in, with the intersectional lens are the ones who were, got into
But
HR.
the universities are just one example, maybe the leading example, but just one example of government institutions. Now, to be fair, they're not literally government institutions, but they are supported by public money and they are subject to government directives and so on. So they're part of a package.
Yeah, but
But
like what?
yet,
I, well, sorry, what, I just want to say, well, like, what I was getting at was, like, I did a deep dive into a lot of this stuff, and I mean, I spent 18 months reading nothing but critical race theory, intersectionality, and some queer theory,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
yeah, I know it was awful. But my thing with that is, starting in the late 90s, coming up to the 2000s, when you had the first PhDs and master's graduates with that intersectional lens, they went into politics, they went in, back into the academy, they went into HR departments, they went into all these different places. And they go, now we're seeing like the long march to the institutions taking its victory lap.
Of course, of
And
course.
so my contention is, yes, we need someone to come in and just put a stop to it, like stop the flow of people graduating out of universities with that
Right.
worldview.
Right.
And then we can start fixing what's going on with the institutions, because until you stop that, until you stop the,
So the question is whether or not that's possible. Right? So the question is whether or not it's possible to reform all of these institutions who have all of these people with all these ideas inside their heads, or whether you just have to start again. And I don't see anybody on the horizon who's willing to start again, but that is one of the questions you have to ask, because if you just assume that all of these various institutions can simply be reformed by the creation of a few rules, I'm not buying that. I think that the ideas are so deeply embedded and the interests are have such control of the institutions that even if some government were to come along and say, you know what, okay, from now on, if this kind of institution does that, then we're not going to give them any money. Okay, that would be good, but that doesn't fix anything. That they're just going to wait till the next time around. So let me give an example. So when Harper was in power, he reduced the budget of the CBC by some considerable amount. I don't remember how much. And, people, a lot of people approved of that because the CBC was, well, you can see what it is now. But the CBC just hung on until Harper lost and Trudeau won. And now the CBC is sucking even more money off the public teat. So the mistake for my money that Harper made was that he tried to starve the CBC instead of killing it through the heart with a stick. You know, you cannot try to reform institutions with half-hearted measures. It doesn't work.
Oh no, I agree with you. I mean, okay, I'm okay, this might be wishful thinking or whatever. I'm still hoping that there are enough people in some of these institutions that want to go back to a, enlightenment set of values. And so, if you can force these institutions to say, this is the way we're going to be doing things from now on, you'll have a lot of these people just leave. Like, I'm serious. Like, I don't think they would stick around, because if they're going to want to do things a certain way, that's the only way they've been taught. And if you can gut them that way,
I
and
don't
then
th I don't think that's likely to work, because there may well be a proportion of people, a number of people who do prefer enlightenment values and want things to be reformed, but they are the vast minority, and most of the people inside these institutions, and the CBC is a perfect example. Can you imagine a reformed CBC being given a, marching orders by a new conservative government, and the people inside the CBC who are, now the people who are now there inside, these are not old-time journalists. I mean, all the old-time journalists, and there were some really good journalists that went through the CBC. Terrific. I used to listen to them on the radio when I was, when I all the way through. But those people are largely gone. And the people who are now at the CBC, I would think, would simply find another way around it because they believe this. They believe that the story they are telling, the narrative they are committed to, is the truth. And if a government tells them not to tell the truth, then they are going to find a way to do what they think their job is, which is to defeat the government. And the language will change and the approach will change. It'll be memos saying you can't do this and you can't do that. And it'll be, it'll, you know, could very well look like they are obeying the directives from on high, but it won't be so. And you're just going to get a Pyrrhic victory, if any at all. And then things will get worse again once the power changes again.
I'm just mulling around ideas of like how the how some change can be done. Do we need? Okay, I agree with you with the CBC. I mean, first of all, I think a lot of the media is dying out anyways, thanks to the internet. So maybe we get better sources coming from there. But then again, you're at the mercy of whoever's giving you information.
Sure, but this is one of the basic premises that I'm talking about, though. We the people have to change the ideas in our heads. And here's an example of what I mean. For some reason, we have grown up, and perhaps because it was we had such a few number of information sources when, you know, when you and I were kids, there were the networks and there were the newspapers, and that was basically it.
Yep.
Right? And people have grown up with this idea that they are owed the truth, that newspapers and news channels and so on are obliged to tell the truth. And the assumption is that what they hear is true. And the assumption, for my money, ought to be the reverse. In an information age, your premise has to be that whatever you hear is probably false. And be comfortable with that. Be comfortable with it because people, free speech does not depend upon telling the truth. People are allowed to lie. That's part of their free speech. And so if you have newspapers, for example, who are writing stuff that is either biased or literally not true, you know, so what? Because you got a million other sources of information. And it's your job as a citizen, I would say, to go and read as many things as you want to in order to figure out for yourself what you think is true and to stop assuming that what you seem to read as an official report of something is true because it's not an official anything.
No, I mean, okay,
And if it were official something, then that'd be even more reason not to believe it.
I didn't trust the media once I got into like once I
Yeah.
hit around 18. Like I was just like, okay, these people, there's, and that was late 80s, and even back then, I was like, okay, there's, some of this is not right. But then when I went and worked overseas, and I just saw the outright lies coming out of the media. Like I worked in Afghanistan for a while, and I remember being on Kandahar, and Kandahar was a huge base. Like the inside perimeter was 9 kilometers. It would take you an hour to walk from one end to the other end. So if there was a rocket attack on one part of the base, you might not necessarily even know, or you might not even get alarms on another section of the base. And I remember one night there was an attack, and people were just going to their shelters, and it wasn't, it was just. After a while, you get a little blasé about it. I saw reporters. There was a little boardwalk area in the center of the base, and I saw reporters, recording stories from there. And later that night, in the Canadian mess, CBC was playing, and I could hear them reporting on the story. And I'm like, "You guys are liars. That's none of that happened." Another thing was I was in Haiti after the earthquake, and a hurricane was about to make landfall. And there's CNN standing beside this little stream, and we would pass by that stream every day to work. And by the time Thomas hit, we'd already been there about 8 months. And it was a little bit of drizzle, and don't even know which CNN reporter it was. They're making it sound like, oh my God, look at this water running down through the middle of the city. And it's like, that stream's been there forever. It's you're just complete and utter bullshit. So after my stint overseas, when I came back, I just like the distrust I had for the media after that point was, I kind of jumped on the Michael Malice bandwagon, even though I didn't know who he was. But it was just like, you guys are evil. You guys lie through your teeth all the time. And it's, I think once you see that broken, you start distrusting any everything. So like, I don't necessarily mean that it has to be the media. It could be, whatever, trust in the universities, trust in,
Sure, but I think that goes along with it, right? So
yeah.
again, here's the dichotomy, if you like, the pair of choices. And one choice is to say, that those people who have expertise, whether they're a professional journalist, whatever that is, or a medical doctor or a lawyer or an engineer or a technocrat of some kind, their role, because they have knowledge, their role is to tell us what to do or to tell us what the truth is. That's one choice. The other choice is to say, look, experts, and I'm not dissing expertise, but experts are there to give opinions and to offer advice. Our job is to decide which advice we want to follow. And those two things are quite different. And we are solidly in the first situation. We, for some reason, think that people with expertise have the authority to tell us all what to do. That this is what happened during COVID. I would much rather a society live in a society in which the role of experts was to disagree with each other, and for me to get the chance to listen to them disagree. And then to decide for myself what the truth was. That's the way I think it should work. But we're a long way from that.
Okay, I just want to read you this quote because what you were saying just brings this to mind. Okay, the seeker after the truth is not one who studies the writings of the ancients and puts his trust in them, but rather one who suspects his faith in them and questions what he gathers from them. So this was written by Ibn al-Haytham. This was written about 1,000 years ago, and it's, I see. If you read Mill, he that only knows his side of the argument knows little of that, right? That's Al-Haytham saying basically the same thing. It's so I agree with you there. Yes, we need to be able to have a reasoned, so
And
experts go.
it's difficult though, right? Because people are going to say, and they have a point. They're going to say, well, look, but the world is too complicated for me to come to my own conclusion about all these different things. I don't have the expertise or the background. I can't take the time to study all the papers and the articles and so on. I just can't do it. So I need to be able to trust some people to tell me what the story is. And I, in practical terms, I hear that and I understand it, but I'm sorry, that's not the way it can be. Because if you are determined to do it that way, then you are giving up your agency. You are putting your fortunes in the hands of other people, and people with authority are not a good choice for that. So part of being a free citizen is to insist upon making your own decisions about things, even when it's complicated, even when it's difficult, because your life is in your own hands.
Yeah, I mean, okay. Let's say I don't know if you read or saw the movie Starship Troopers, and they had a, basically everything that was going to go on, everyone voted on it. And you had to be in the military to be a citizen. I mean, I don't even want to go that far. But let's just say during COVID, so two experts come on, one who says mask, one who says doesn't mask, and then you have an online vote. Should we have masks or not? But who's deciding which experts to put on? That's another level
Oh
of.
yeah. Oh yeah, but you see, but I wouldn't do it that way at all. And I wouldn't even go for the vote. I mean, I don't think that the government has any role in deciding who the experts are that should be heard. And secondly, I don't believe that the majority has any business telling me whether to wear a mask or not. So when I say that it's up to citizens on their own to decide who's telling the truth and who to rely upon, I mean all of us individually. I don't mean as a group. I don't mean that. So during COVID, if we had that kind of referendum, it might, well, at a certain point in the story, it might well have been the case that a majority, I don't know this for sure, but a majority of people might have been so, you know, whipped up into a frenzy of fear by all the propaganda that they would have voted in favor of masking and in favor of lockdowns or in favor of, you know, vaccine passports. Who knows? And if they had so voted, I'm sorry, I still don't agree that it's legitimate because it's not the decision that I have made for my own life and my own risk. My risk is my business, and I don't care what the majority thinks.
Yeah, okay. And I mean, I agree with you there. So let's say when COVID first, Canada started getting locked down in March of 2020. And then I was paying attention to what was going on. Then I was looking at what Sweden was doing, and I'm like, these people are crazy. What the hell are they doing? Because I saw like their was it Our World in Data or whatever that website is that just it's just facts, right? It's just numbers. I'm looking at the hospitalization in Sweden, I'm looking at the death rate, and I'm like, they're crazy. It's not working. But by August of that year, the Swedish model started looking better. And I mean, you had certain states as well. I think Florida comes to mind. I mean, I could be wrong about that, but who, those states had fewer restrictions. And so you could then do a comparison, but no one was doing that. So I think if you'd asked me in March, I would have said, yeah, let's lock this mother down because that's,
And a lot of people thought that. And a lot of people, well, so some people have had the courage to go back and say, you know what, I've looked at the information now and I'm changing my mind. And you know, that's fair and good for them. I respect that. But I've also made this argument. I've said to, and you know, I know a lot of science and medical people who are very heavily involved in this investigation into what actually happened during COVID, and I respect their work very much. But I've made this argument to them. I've said this: look, we need to know all of this. We need to know what you're working on. We need to know what the data actually said, and so on. But the bottom line is the medical facts never mattered. They never mattered because some of us knew in March of 2020 that you cannot do this. Doesn't matter if it works. I don't care if lockdown works or not. You can't lock healthy people in their homes. I don't care what the ramifications are because that's a violation of their right to decide their own lives. And if we accept that idea, no matter what the facts are, then this is a line you cannot cross.
Yeah, no, I can respect that. Look, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but there was a couple of things I just wanted to ask you about, and maybe you can
Yes,
enlighten
by
me
all
on
means.
these. Okay, so the ruling on the Emergencies Act, and now they say the Liberal government says they're going to appeal it. So let's say they lose the appeal. What is, I mean, in my mind, Trudeau needs to resign at that point, but if that's going to happen or not, I doubt it. But anyways, like what would be the ramifications for the government if they lose that appeal?
Well, they could be. Well, they'll be both political, of course. That means that they will have been that the judgment that they violated the civil liberties of Canadians on a basis that was invalid, ultra vires, and unlawful will be have been confirmed. So that you know, there are political consequences for that, maybe. The other one is legal, but that those legal consequences are could be quite narrow in the sense that those people, for example, who had their bank accounts frozen. And frozen illegally now will have, and these suits have been started already. Those people will have a cause of action against the government for compensation for their for the intrusion upon their rights and freedoms. But it's not going to require the prime minister to step down. I mean, that's a political call, not a legal one. No judge is going to say that as a result of this decision. And we'll just have to see how it shakes out. And these appeals might take a while too, because there's two more levels to get to potentially. One is the Federal Court of Appeal, which is the next one. And then maybe there is the Supreme Court of Canada. So, don't hold your breath.
Yeah, I mean, I figured these things are gonna. I didn't expect any kind of decision, next week or anything like that. I figured
No,
it's gonna
I
take a
understand.
while.
Sure,
But
yeah.
it's the second thing is this new proposed law, so Bill C-63. But before you get into that, like I said, I didn't vote for the Liberals. I didn't vote for anyone in like 2015, 2019. But in 20, I believe it was 2016 that they came out with motion M-103. So I don't know if you remember that motion. It's the, they called it the religious racism or religious bigotry, I can't remember, but they focused on Islamophobia. And I mean, it's a motion, it's not legally binding, but when I read the text of the motion, I said, this is paving the way for more legislation. And a lot of people thought I was crazy. A lot of people were like, oh, what are you talking about? There's not gonna be legislation out of this. I'm like, they're talking about a whole of government approach to curb racism.
Yes.
Can't do that without legislation. A motion's not going to do anything. And then we started getting speech codes and speech laws,
Yes.
more and
Yes.
more of them. And there was
Yes.
more and more curtailing of our speech, starting, I guess you can say, C-16. And then there was, Facebook doesn't show news stories anymore. And then you have now Bill C-63, which, I mean, I'm looking at that. I'm just, I'm sorry. You can put me under house arrest for if
Yes.
you suspect that I might, commit a hate crime. I
That's right.
mean,
Yeah.
where's our, innocent until proven guilty? There
Right,
is none.
right, right, right. I totally agree with you. Completely agree with you. But again, this has roots in the past. So over a period of years, the Supreme Court has said that there are some kinds of restrictions on speech. Well, of course, there are inevitably going to be restrictions on speech that are legal. So, for example, if I go up to somebody on the street and I simply say to them in words, give me your wallet or I'll stab you, well, that's an assault. And I don't have the free speech to the right to say that, even though it says free speech in the charter. So there are restrictions on free speech, even though we have the right. But over years, Supreme Court of Canada has said that some restrictions are okay, even though they're not threatening violence. We already have a hate speech provision in our criminal code. In my opinion, that shouldn't be there,
Yeah,
because,
I
right,
agree with you 100%.
that means we're not taking free speech seriously. And it's just been an incre- you used the metaphor earlier of a frog in boiling water. This is exactly what is happening. We've been in the water for a long time, and the water's coming to a boil. And now we see C-63, and geez, you know what? C-63 is bad. Maybe it can be defeated, but we're really slow off the mark. We should have objected to restrictions on our speech long ago, and we
Yeah,
put up with it. And
we
now
should
here we
have
are.
been, people should have been, freaking out about it when Leech Lake
Absolutely,
happened.
absolutely, yes.
And okay, I remember arguing about this. So I was, so let's see, it was in '86. I was in a history class, but we were talking about, Canadian government stuff, and we did like a little mock parliament thing, and we discussed the notwithstanding clause.
Right.
And even back then, I said, we got to get rid of this.
Oh.
And no, but I mean, I realize that some provinces like Saskatchewan, I think, or was it Saskatchewan or Ontario? I mean, they have used it for things I've liked,
Yeah.
but just because it can be used for things I like, it can be used for, like, Quebec has used a notwithstanding clause. So they used it on every piece of legislation from 1980 to 1988.
Yeah.
And then they used it, depending on the party that was in, they used it, for
Yeah,
different.
but so I think my position on notwithstanding might be different than yours. And here's why. I don't approve of legislatures doing things that infringe rights. Not at all. And lots of provinces have done so. I totally agree with that. And in a perfect world, they wouldn't be able to. But the problem is this. So our conception of government was supposed to be checks and balances. I mean, more so in the US Constitution, but even in the Canadian, right? And our original problem, way, let's go back to England, way back when, in the time of the Magna Carta and the and the and the and the and the and so on, you know, over a long period of time. The problem was the king. The king was a tyrant. And what did we do to escape from the king? Well, we took powers away from the king and gave them to legislatures, because at least legislatures were elected. Problem was that legislatures can be tyrants too, just as you're alluding to. Provincial legislatures, federal parliament can do things that infringe rights. And so what do we do about that? Well, we took power away from legislatures and gave it to courts. And the problem is that courts now have gone, for my money, off the track. And they are being the tyrants in some respects. So the problem is, okay, well, where do you go? Where do you go now? You don't want the executive, that is the king, to have all the power. You don't want the legislature to have all the power without check from the court. You don't want the court to have all the power, because look at what they do. The court is the one who has said these restrictions on speech are okay. Right? And so
Yeah.
here's the role of 33. 33 is the notwithstanding clause. 33, if you like, so the charter is the check on the legislature. Section 33 is the check on the courts. Because if the courts go off and misbehave, at least you got a release valve where a legislature can say, you know what? I don't care what you say, courts, we're putting this through because, you know, you're out of control. And
Yeah.
so I'm okay with it being there.
See, my problem with it is the sections that it can override. Like, it's notwithstanding like most of section two, which is where all our civil liberties are.
I understand.
And
I
that
understand,
that
but you're proceeding on an assumption, though, and the
yeah,
assumption
no,
is,
I understand your argument and I get it. I just,
right.
okay, maybe I'm thinking about a perfect world, but like, you know, when you mentioned I mean, this is gonna be the last thing I'll ask you just because you mentioned it in the courts, like how the courts are going. You know, they're going off the tri or off the tracks. Like I've been saying this for a while now, and I, you know, okay, so take CRT. That came out of like Harvard Law School. Like
Sure.
it, a lot of this nonsense started in law schools.
Absolutely.
So I'm like not,
Absolutely.
I'm, you know, when people are like, oh my God, look at what's going on with the lawyers and the courts. I'm like, well, yeah, but it started in law schools. What do you expect?
It's like, what did you expect?
Yeah, I mean, like in Canada, what we've, you know, like racially imposed sentences
Right? Yes.
now. You know,
Yes.
it's ridiculous. Like we shouldn't have that. And it's, you know, I agree with you about our Constitution that like I wish we had a First Amendment here. I think the best law to protect free speech is the First Amendment. And I mean,
Yeah,
there.
that's because I mean, but to give credit where credit is due, that is in large part due to the American courts. I mean, the wording in the First Amendment is no more precise than it is in our Section 2, the Charter. So our courts could have done the same thing as the American courts did, but they didn't. And so that's on them.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's. I mean, people don't look into it enough. It's. You didn't start really getting the protections on free speech in the US until after the First World
That
War.
is correct. That
You
is
know,
true.
that's
Yes, that's
all when all these litigation started happening and people were, you know,
yep.
taking advantage of the courts and then going through. I mean,
And
you.
it is absolutely true that the history of free speech jurisprudence in the US is very varied over time. Not it's not black and white at all. I totally agree with that. Yes.
I mean, you'll always have the misquoted Oliver Wendell Holmes quote, which Trudeau also misquoted a couple of times. You know, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. It's like, no, he actually said you cannot knowingly and wrongfully yell fire in a crowded theater. But if
Right.
the theater is on fire,
Yes,
you
you
have to
can.
yell
That's
fire.
right.
Yeah, you know,
That's
like
right.
it's,
Yes.
so yeah, I mean, it's I agree with you. Like, if we don't have that. If our courts, you know, if our courts aren't gonna protect us, then we do need some sort of protection from them, and it's just then it's a question of balancing act. Like I don't want to keep you too much longer, and I know you're busy, so thank you very much. It was really good talking to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you want to let people know where they can get a hold of you, if you send
Yes.
me any links that you have, I'll put them in the description.
Great. Okay. And well, just I can say it very quickly. I'll send it to you as well, but our website is rightsprobe, all one word, dot org.
Okay, great. I'll put that in. Well, thank you very much, Bruce. This is a great talk, and
Thank you, Abe. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot, and thank you everyone for listening.